let's take a look on Chavit Dalet Amud Aleph. And we were talking about the Agadita here and comparing Eretz Yisrael to Bavel. V'yasoi nai va'ere. Let's see if we can find this. This is a pasuk in Zechariah with a very strange kind of nevuah that we would try to understand. So let's see if the wide lines, you count down around 10 lines down from the wide lines,
12.
A little bit more, yeah, 12, and you'll see the first word in the line is Shebet Bavel. So the pasuk says the following, Ve'esah einai va'era. Now the Malach shows Zechariah a vision, and Zechariah records the vision and then his dialogue back and forth with the Malach to try to figure out what this vision means. And this is in the fifth chapter of Zechariah. Behine Shtayim Noshim. Now we're going to see as we go through this Gemara that the Noshim here is really irrelevant, and the commentaries are going to try to figure out why the vision had to be seen with Noshim. But Yotzos, they're going out, V'ruach b'kanfehem, it sounds like they're flapping their wings in the wind, V'lahena. And what, you know, we're going to describe these nashim, knafayim, they have wings, kekanfei hachasida. If I'm not mistaken, tell me how he translates. I think a chasida is an ostrich or something like that.
Or was it a stork?
A stork? Is a stork the same as an ostrich? I don't know. Anyway,
a stork. He just says chasida here.
Oh, he doesn't even translate. Oh, I see. It's good. You know, when I finally get to a word that I need art school for, he just transliterates the word.
A stork or an ostrich.
Yeah. I think that in the Chumash it's a stork.
I guess a stork has very heavy wings. Vatisa ena esha efa. Efa is a utensil that's used to weigh something. And again, very strange. They're carrying up this vessel, bein hashamayim ubein haaretz. They haven't yet reached the shamayim; they left the haaretz. Va'omar al hamalach hadover bi. So I, Zechariah, say I was confused about the meaning of this vision. So I turned to the malach and I said, Ana hema molichos esa'efa, where are they taking this vessel? Vayomer Eli, and he responded, Livnos la bayis, be eretz shinar, to build some sort of a permanent location, a permanent bayis, in the land of Shinar. And the land of Shinar is identified as Bavel. So in our discussion here about the Talmidei Chachamim of Bavel, that we said they were Merorim Zed Zeh Malachim. Remember, they had a certain bitterness one to the other. They were Mechablim Zed Zeh. So this next piece here, in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, is going to somehow give us another, if you will, a negative view of Bavel, Shinar. Now, what is the pshat in the psukim? What is HaKadosh Baruch Hu showing Zechariah on a simple level before we see Rabbi Yochanan on a deeper level? So the simple, straightforward pshat in this nevuah is the following. God is revealing to Zechariah what will be the future punishment of the Bnei Yisrael as a result of their sins. And V'yasai nai v'ere, I see v'inei shtayim noshim yotzos mikodesh HaKadoshim V'ruach k'shura b'kanfehem. So these two noshim are leaving the Kodesh Kadoshim with a certain wind that's blowing their wings, v'lahena. And these two women are connected, Mechubarim, Knafayim, Rechavos, Ve'aruchos. They both have very wide wings that are long and wide, and they can sort of connect themselves. Kikanfei Achasido, like the wings of a stork. Vatisaena Esha Eifa. And they're carrying this vessel, which is used for weighing. Bein Shamayim, Bein Hashamayim, Bein Ha'aretz. V'omar la malacha dover bi, ana, to where are they going? Hei molichos za'if. V'yom elai, livnos la bayis, bi eretz shinar. In other words, the Beis HaMikdash is going to be destroyed, and the people of Israel will go into Golus. They'll end up in Babylonia. Hanavi omer sharash tei nashim. Why two women? Shemarames al shtei umos. These are the two nations into which the Jewish people will be exiled. And one is called Bavel or Shinar, the other is called Kazdim. Shalochim es bnei Yisrael agolos. And now they are being taken into the exile. V'kovim sham mekomam, mishkanam. And there they will establish a permanent life in exile. And this is all a punishment for the sin of rimu b'midos. You know, the Gemara says that the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed amongst various other reasons is because of the avera of cheating, of swindling. And if you have a midah, a measurement that is not precise, then you could cheat someone. So the seller cheats the buyer, etc., etc. So that's the remez here, that they're going to go into Golus because of this eifa, this imprecise measurement. And now he quotes in the footnote here, a netziv mivalojin. The netziv comments on the very next line in the Gemara. Amar Rabbi Yochanan Mishum Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, Zo, no, it's this prophecy and vision that describes the two ladies represent the Yetzer Hara in two different forms. So the power of the Yetzer Hara is to project a certain negative attribute, a Midah Ra. And in this case, there are two Nashim, which represent two Midos Ros. And what are they? They are Chanufa and Gasus Ruach. Chanufa, which means to flatter someone when it's not really true, it's not really precise, you do it for ulterior motives, that's called chanufa. And that is implied by the words kikanfei hachasida, like the wings of the stork. And why is that? Shehachanuf, hachonef rather, the one who's flattering his friend, or perhaps he's flattering someone who's not his friend, is mare es atzmo kichosid. Right? The chasida is miloshon chesed or chosid. And when you put on this facade and you start flattering a person, it looks like you're big bal chesed, that you're flattering him and giving him a good feeling. But really it's all false. So the Netziv says the following, that Chanufa is really a subcategory of Sheker. It's another manifestation of falsifying the truth. But he says there are two types of Chanufa, and he says one is worse than the other. Let's see if we'll guess which is the worst kind. Yesh Chanufa shemachnif la'cherim, that he flatters others, ve'inyona Sheker, kidei l'shakir v'loma l'rosha shu tzadik. You know, this, the other guy is really an evildoer, but you tell him he's a great guy because you want to find favor in his eyes. So you lie and you flatter him, and hopefully you'll get some sort of benefit from that. Then he has a second category of chanufa. Yesh chanufa shemachnif es atzmo. It means that he's really not sincere with himself. He's a hypocrite. And he shows others, and even to himself, that he's a tzaddik, when in truth he's really a rasha. So he fools himself into calling himself a tzaddik. Sometimes people are self-delusive, right? You know, you tell yourself, oh, I'm a great guy, but really you're a tzaddik. So that's chanifa towards oneself. You are flattering and fabricating yourself because you're a big hypocrite. And he says the following: which of the two midos are worse? When you show flattery towards a rasha, and call him a tzaddik when you really don't mean it, or when you fool yourself? What would you say? Which is worse?
Fool yourself.
Correct. That's what the Nitzuv says, that when you fool yourself, that's even a lot worse. He says that kind of hypocrisy towards yourself is a mida grua, yoseh grua me'arishona.
Self-aggrandizement.
Yeah, but what leads to all kinds of other things. Once you do yourself, it's like one person, you compliment somebody, you know, could be he actually deserved it, even. He might be wrong.
Well, that's not chanufa. Chanufa means he doesn't deserve it. But it's bad enough, but it's worse when you falsify the truth to yourself and you evaluate yourself as a tzaddik when you're really not. I mean, that delusion, self-delusion, is very, very dangerous. So, Rab Yochanan, Mishum Rab Shim Bar Yochai, Chanufa V'gasus HaRuach. So, Chanufa, according to the Nitziv, means when he's Chonuf is Atzmo. He fools himself. Like the Chasida tells herself that she's a Chasida, you know, that she's doing great for the others, but she really doesn't do much for others. And now there's a second Midara, which is symbolically represented by the second woman, and that's Gasus HaRuach, which means Gaiva, which means conceit. And the Gemara, as you know, says very bad things about someone who's conceited, and it's very, very negative, it's very corruptive, it's very destructive. HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't want to be near someone who's a Gas Ruach. He finds a Gas Ruach Toeva, abomination, and he's repulsed by someone who is a Gas Ruach. Now, these two ladies that are representing the Yetzer Hara for two different negative attributes are somehow floating between Shamayim and Aretz. In other words, that floating represents that these Midos are coming down from Shamayim and they are flowing to two different levels, or shall we say forms or expressions of Midos Ros, of Chanufa and Gasus Ruach. And where do they end up? So the Pasuk says Be'eretz Shinar, which is Bavel. So it means that these Midos of Chanufa and Gasus Ruach that are Koveh Makom, they now want to set themselves in a permanent way, they end up in Bavel, which is called in the Pasuk Shinar. Correct? Shinar, but that is Bavel. Now, I have a note here, the name of the Ritva. The Ritva has a whole calculation about the volume of an Eifah. Eifah, again, we said, was a utensil that was used to weigh a certain volume. And that volume, he says, equals 18 kav. Again, we'd have to go through this. The best way of doing this, if you wanted to really know what it is, would be to use Rabbi Frank, Yitzhak Frank's book, which we once had here, called Talmudic Dictionary. You familiar with that book? If you don't own it, you have to buy it. I have a few copies of it, but none of them are really here with me now. Anyway, so there's something called an Eifah. An Eifah is made up of three Sa'in, and every Sa'a is made up of six Kavin. So if you multiply 6 times 3, you get 18. So there are 18 Kavin in Eifah. Now, if you take the number 18 and you divide it into half, you have 9 and 9. So now, the total of this Eifah, when it's split into these two Noshim, of Gasus Ruach and Chanufa, which is 18 Kav, means that each of these two Midos Ros get 9 Kav. So there are 9 Kav of Gasus Ruach and 9 of Chanufa. That's how the Ritva understands this remez here, this symbolic representation. And he says that the Eifah is now hovering between Shamayim and Aretz. And he says the reason for that is because HaMachnif LaNoshim, when you flatter people, is Mekubal Ba'aretz. He says that people down here on the earth appreciate flattery. They like to be flattered. You know, we used to say flattery will get you everywhere, if you remember that phrase. Ach eino merusa b'shamayim, but up in the heavens, they don't want flattery. They don't recognize. They don't appreciate that because it's really just sheker. On the other hand, says the Ritva, hamizgaya, a person who is full of himself, right? He's haughty. Eino mekuval ba'aretz. There's no room for gaiva whatsoever on this land. We have to go down on earth, we have to go to the other extreme, running away from gaiva. Ach b'shamayim, there is such a thing as gaiva. And the pasuk says in Tehillim, Hashem melech geus lavesh. Hashem melech geus lavesh. So there's geus, which is geus up in shamayim. So gaiva has its place up in shamayim. Chanufa is appreciated down in the aretz. Now when we combine these two midos in the form of the eifa that's being carried here by these two ladies, lo yuchlu lo leches, they can't end up neither in Shamayim, because there won't be any room in Shamayim for Chanufa, and not in the Aretz, because down here there's no room for a Balgaiva. And therefore they're basically floating somewhere in between. They don't want him upstairs, they don't want him downstairs. So the Ritva says that where do they end up? They end up in Bavel. Why do they end up in Bavel? Because he says the Talmidei Chachamim in Bavel, as we learned yesterday, are chovlim zed zeb alocha. They try to destroy one another in these battles, in these controversies of alocha. And that's considered derech gaiva v'gasus ruach. When I say to you, your logic doesn't make any sense, that because I'm building myself up at your expense, but hayu machnifim li ovre avera. Now, again, where that comes to play, I don't know. But I'll just read to you what the Ritva says, and the Marsha expands upon this. That in Bavel, not only were they guilty of the illness of Gaiva and Gassus Ruach, but they were also guilty of Chanifa. And in Bavel, they would flatter Ovre Avera in order to get the best deal. You know, if you have a mafioso guy, so you tell him how great he is, and hopefully, you know, he'll treat you nicely. V'yachlu shtei amidos l'shtakei Hashem, and the atmosphere in Bavel was such that because the people in Bavel were guilty of both Gassus Ruach and Chanifa, therefore these two midos could settle there, and they would find their natural habitat in the atmosphere of Bavel. Again, all this is very negative about Bavel. Later on, we're going to see a major note here about why the Talmud Bavli, therefore, is so critical and it's greater than the Talmud Yerushalmi. So leave that question on the back burners. We'll come back to it. Now he quotes the Ben Ish Chai, who says that why did the pasuk, why did the vision that Zechariah received have to use Noshim if these Noshim are just representative of Midos Ros? And according to his take on this, a woman gives birth the Osa Peros. So we have the fruits, the next generation that comes from the woman. And the symbolic use of the ladies here in this context for the Midos Ros is because Midos Ros Osin Peros. And he says, Mishi Yeshlo Midos Elu Sofo Lovely De Kama Vakama Veros Umichsholos. And I'm reminded here, the Rambam in Hilchas Tshuva, the Rambam says that we have to do Tshuva not just on Maisim, on Averos and so forth, or the lack of mitzvahs, but also on Midos Ros. And that's why Hilchas Tshuva in the Rambam comes after Hilchas Deos, which is Hilchas Midos. Because if you really want to get down to the root of evil, you have to get down to the Midos. Because the Midos Osen Peros, they will have repercussions. And they will spill over into Kama Vakama Avonos Umechsholos. That's the language of the Ben Ish Chai. So that's the choice of the use of women here in this metaphor. The Gemara now is very perplexed here because there's another location which is close to Bavel but not in Bavel, which is called Elam. And once again, I hope now the art school will come up, come in handy here and tell me what Elam is.
They say it could be Persia.
Could be Persia. Okay, so we don't know exactly where Elam is.
It's mentioned in Bereshit, is it the same? with the four kings and the five kings, one of them was Melech Elam. So
maybe you should look in there and see if anyone identifies that as Persian. As Persian, that would be very helpful. Okay, so what happens now? The Gemara asks the following question. We have a principle of Asara Kavim Gasus Yardu Yolam. There are 10 measures of conceit that come down into this world. Tisha Notla Elam V'Achas Kol Olam Kula. 9, which is 90% of the Gasus, comes down to Persia, to Elam. And the rest, the balance, the 10%, that's spread out throughout the world. But it seems that there's no room for Gasus Ruach in Bavel, but rather in Elam. So the Gemara answers in Lebavel Nachas. As we saw in the simile of the vision of Zechariah, Gasus comes down to Bavel. And that's where it finds its natural habitat. But that's only at stage one. Then, like a contagious disease, it spreads. Vishtarbevei, hu dishtarbev li'elam. And then, in like concentric circles, it moves towards Elam, which is smuchal Bavel, which is next to Bavel. So the original Gasus Ruach is in Bavel. What do we see today? Today we'll see Gasus Ruach in Elam, because it started in Bavel and spread to Elam. Deka Nami Dechsiv. I would like to indicate this from the Pasuk itself, because initially the Pasuk says that Zechariah saw these two Noshim, these two Midos Ros. And then the Pasuk says that the Malach turns to Zechariah and he says, Livnos La Bayis Fieretz Shinar. La is in the Hebrew grammatical singular. And it doesn't seem to make any sense if in the first Pasuk Zechariah sees two women and then they set up their habitat in Eretz Shinar. It should have said Lahen in the plural, rather than La. Shmamino, this teaches us that initially there were two women, and one of them represents the mid of Gasus Ruach, the other the mid of Chanufa, and ultimately at stage two, the Shnia, the second one, is not going to be found in Eretz Shinar, so that what you'll find in Eretz Shinar is Chanufa, but what you'll find today, as far as Gasus Ruach is concerned, is Elam. That's where ultimately this Midah of Gasus Ruach is going to be found. Now the Gemara continues to clarify, is there any Gasus Ruach left in Bavel today? And he says the following. Is there no Gasus Ruach left in Bavel? That the Pasuk uses the singular to indicate that now that woman that represents Gasus Ruach ends up in... I'm sorry, that only that woman that represents Chanufa ends up in Bavel, but the woman that represents Gasus Ruach is not in Bavel. She's in Elam. So Amar Mar, we have a statement of some anonymous Chacham who says that Simon Legasus Ruach Anius, that when a country, when a nation, a society is guilty of Gasus Ruach, if that plague is so widespread, then the punishment will be Anius, will be poverty. So if I find a country that's underprivileged, then paradoxically that's indicative of the fact that it's guilty of Gasus Ruach. Now where do we find Anius? In Bavel Nachas. We find in Bavel a tremendous amount of Anirs. And this is a Gemara in Masechta Kiddushin on Daf Mem Tes. The Gemara says, Asara kabim anirs yardu li olam v'tishimem notla bavel. So bavel takes 90% of anirs. And therefore, if we assume that anirs is a punishment for gasus ruach, then it has to mean that there's gasus ruach in bavel. And you're telling me, no, gasus ruach started in bavel, but then it moved over to Elim. So the Gemara to Elam. So the Gemara answers, "My Anius, you misunderstood the word Anius. Anius is not a financial description of poverty, but rather Anius b'Torah." Now this is wild because this is so antithetical to what we know. That's why I told you we have to wait for a certain footnote here. But it sounds like in Bavel there's no Torah. Again, they might not be poor people in terms of bank accounts, but there's no Torah in Babylonia. And this is based on another statement of Rabbi Yochanan. The Siv in Shir HaShirim, it says, Achos lanu ktana v'shadayim ein la. Now, the purpose of Shadayim is to give milk. The milk represents the Torah, and the Shadayim represents the Talmidei Chachamim that are meant to transmit the Torah. And the Pasuk in Shir HaShirim is describing a case of an Achos ktana, and she doesn't have Shadayim. Omer Rabbi Yochanan, what is the symbolic message? All of Shir HaShirim is a metaphor. The Achos is Elam. Why? Because what happens in Elam? Zachsa lilmod, v'lo zachsa lilamed. Now, to expand upon this, the Yad Ramah says that there were two great giants who were in Elam, and they are Daniel and Mordechai. Now Mordechai in Persia makes sense. I don't know that Daniel was in Persia. I can't figure that out. But in any event, these were the two great scholars in Elam, or Elam. And in Elam, they were not able to teach Torah. So it means that the nation was not made up of those people who could accept or were interested in receiving the Torah of the two great teachers, the two great giants, of Daniel and Mordechai. And as a result, these giants had to learn for themselves, and they were not able to transmit the Torah to others. And this is what goes on in Elam. So that if you ask me, where is Anius? If Anius means Anius b'Torah, and Anius is a punishment for what? For Gasus Ruach? That's going to be in Elam. Right? So you thought that Bavel is a place which is underprivileged and it's Anius? No. The real place for Anius, if Anius means Anius b'Torah, is in Elam. Because even though you had great scholars in Elam, but they were not able to pass their Torah on to others. And that's called Shadayim Ein La. So even though Lilmo, they were able to study Torah, but they weren't able to teach Torah because they didn't have a clientele of people who were really interested in receiving their Torah. And in the note here, he says, based on Rashi and Kiddushin, Lo hayadoram oskim v'Torah, the members of the Jewish nation at that time were not dedicated to the study of Torah. V'lachein lo zachu l'lamei Torah. They couldn't teach Torah because there were no recipients who were interested in accepting that Torah, receiving that Torah. And therefore, ki'ilu, it's like lo hoya lehem shadayim lahanit. They didn't have the ability to give nourishment because there was nobody, there were no buyers, there were no takers. Ha'torah nimshal l'chalav. The Torah is compared to milk. And the Melamed is compared to Shadayim. And this is all based on a pasuk in Yeshaya, Esmi Yored Deya, Vesmi Yavin Shmua, Gmule Mechalav Atike Mishadayim. But in Bavel, who was the great leader of the Jewish nation in Bavel? That was Ezra. And Ezra not only studied for himself, but he also taught Torah to the Rabbim. He was able to transmit the Torah. So this is the good news about Bavel. And it means that in Bavel, they did not suffer this plague of Adius, because the original Gasus Ruach that came down from Shemayim to Bavel moved on to Elam. Now, Ezra, on the other hand, the Pasuk says, Hechin levavo lidrosh es Torah Hashem. He prepared himself to teach and transmit the Torah of God. Velasos ulalame b'Yisrael choku mishpat. So that's the good news about Bavel. Now there's a question here. The Torah says that the name of Bavel was given because, this is in Bereishis Yud Aleph, Al Kain Karashmo Bavel, Kishon Bolal Hashem Sfas Kol Haaretz Uvishom Efitzom Hashem Al Pnei Kol Haaretz. So there's a clear answer in the Torah as to why the name Bavel is appropriate for that location, because that's where Hashem, this is what we call the Tower of Bavel, that's where he confused the languages. So now we don't understand the next line in the Gemara. The Gemara says, my Bavel. What is the meaning of the word Bavel? So he quotes here a sefer called the Gur Aryeh. I don't think it's the Maral. I don't know who it is. But he gives the following, yes, HaTorah kava rak et shem ha-bik'a. There was a bik'a, there was some sort of valley, and that was called Bavel. Our Gemara is talking not about that valley, but about the entire country, the whole Medina, which is called Bavel. So why is it called Bavel? There's another pshat of the Ma'orei Ha'or. He says that the Gemara's question is not on Bavel, but on the Talmud Bavli. And what the Gemara wants to know, my Bavel, is since the name Bavel, lo nitan lo l'shvach el l'gnai, until now, we see based on the Pasuk that we quoted in Bereishis that the name Bavel is pejorative. So why should we use the name Talmud Bavli? We should have called it Talmud Shinari, he says, from Shinar. Why do we dafka call it the Talmud Bavli when the word Bavel is reminiscent of the sin of the Tower of Bavel and the fact that God combined and confused all the languages? Now the top Tosfos here on the page quotes a Rabbeinu Tam that we learn Talmud Bavli. And why do we learn Talmud Bavli? So Rabbeinu Tam says it's based on Rabbi Yochanan's statement right here in the Gemara. Why is Bavel called Bavel? Which we said perhaps, why is Talmud Bavli called Talmud Bavli and not Talmud Shinari? Or perhaps we're talking not about the valley of Bavel, but about the whole country of Bavel. Omar Rabbi Yochanan sheblula b'mikra ublula b'mishnah ublula b'talmud. That the Torah is made up of three different disciplines. The first is what we call Torah shebichsav, otherwise known as mikra, where we read the Torah itself, the words of the Torah. And then we have Torah Shebaal Peh, which is called Mishnah. And finally we get to Talmud. Talmud is the ability to analyze the Torah Shebaal Peh, to reveal its underlying principles and its basic sources and roots. So Rabbeinu Tam says that the reason why we've accepted upon ourselves to study Talmud Bavli is because of a combination of our Gemara, of Rabbi Yochanan, with a Gemara in Masechta Avodah Zarah. The Gemara in Masechta Avodah Zarah tells us that our mitzvah of Talmud Torah should be fulfilled with a daily three-part discipline. Li'olam yeshalesh adam shnosav v'shlish b'mikra shlish b'mishnah shlish b'talmud. He should divide up his time one-third for Mikra, one-third for Mishnah, and one-third for Talmud. And the question that Rabbeinu Tam addresses is, well, I don't see anybody doing that. And the answer is, says Rabbeinu Tam, here in Rabbi Yochanan and our Gemara, Talmud Bavli is Balul. It's a Blila, it's a combination, Blula, B'mikra, B'mishnah, B'talmud. So we can fulfill this three-part curriculum that's required, according to the Gemara of Avodah Zarah, by learning Talmud Bavli. The Rashash says that according to Rabbeinu Tam, when the Gemara asks my Bavel, the Gemara was focused on Talmud Bavli. We've seen this before. And the Gemara wants to know, why is it called Talmud Bavli? And we saw this in a sefer called Ma'orei Or that we mentioned earlier, that the Gemara's question is not about the location Bavel, why it's called Bavel, that we know from the Torah itself, but rather why the Talmud is called Talmud Bavli and not Talmud Shinari. Isn't Talmud Bavli a pejorative term when we associate it with the sin of those who made the Tower of Bavel? And the answer is that if you're asking why the Talmud is called Bavel, that's not a negative term. You're talking about the land calling Bavel, that's pejorative. But if you're talking about the Talmud itself that's called Bavel, that indicates the greatness of Talmud Bavli, because it integrates both Mishnah together with Mikra and together with Talmud. And then he adds another comment to Rashash. And he says he doesn't understand why the Gemara is focused exclusively on Talmud Bavli. Talmud Yerushalmi, he says, is likewise an integration of all these different elements, and yet it's not called Bavli. If the word Bavli has nothing to do with the location, but rather with the content of the Torah and the integration of its various disciplines, then that same word Bavli should have been used as a name for the Talmud of the Yerushalmi, because Yerushalmi likewise is kol. It combines Mikra, Mishnah, and Talmud. And he doesn't have any answer for that question. Then we have a pasuk in Eicha. The Gemara, this is the end of the Sagadita, so we'll have time, Mirz Hashem, to begin the new sugya, the new Mishnah. V'machshakim hoshivani kimase kimese olam. We're talking about a pasuk in Eicha, in which Yirmiyahu HaNavi is crying over the fact that HaKadosh Baruch Hu sent Bnei Yisrael into the very dark Golos, and in the exile we're considered like Mesim, we're like dead people in the darkness of the exile. And it's very interesting, we're talking about the Navi Yirmiyah, but there's also an Amora by the name of Yirmiyah. Elmer Ab Yirmiyah Zed, this word Choshech is an allusion to Talmudah Shel Bavel. The Talmud Bavel is like Choshech, it's like darkness. Meaning, even after we learn the Talmud, we're still in the dark. We're still left with all sorts of doubts and questions. We don't understand. We're like groping in the dark. And here I have to share with you a very important footnote from the Otzer HaGaonim in the name of Haigon, because until now, in the last Gemara, we were differentiating between Elam and Bavel. And we said that although in Elam there's poverty, and greats like Daniel and Mordechai in Elam were not able to learn for others, but rather only for themselves. But in Bavel, we said that we dafka learn the Talmud Bavli because it has that extra element of integrating all the different parts of the Torah. It's Bolul, Min, Mikra, Blula, Mi Mishnah, Blula, Mi Talmud. So why do you describe it as darkness? Fine. So this is the question of Rav Haigon. And he says the following. And I'm going to say it this way, I hope I'm not prejudicing you, but I think he says that there are two historical periods that describe Bavel. He says, Masha Nikra Talmud Bavel Kach. Why does he consider Talmud Bavel as being darkness, and it leaves us in a state of confusion? Zedak Bizman, that's referring to an earlier period of time. Shadayin Hoya Sanhedrin bi Eretz Yisrael, v'chol g'dolei hachachamim hoyu sham bi Eretz Yisrael. Initially, in the first period of history, the greats of Israel and the great teachers of Torah were located in Eretz Yisrael. It was the Sanhedrin, made up of 71 elders, and they were the great giants of Torah. They were in Eretz Yisrael. And all the great Chachamim were there in the land of Israel. He adds to boot that the Avirah, the atmosphere of Eretz Yisrael, is conducive to the study of Torah and the success in acquiring its Chachmah. And therefore, the Bnei Eretz Yisrael, they knew the Mishnayos, and not only did they know the Mishnayos, they understood the reason and the logic and the principles that underlie the Mishnayos. Aval b'Bavel, in Babel at that period of time, they were suffering from Xeros and Shmados, and therefore they didn't even know the explanations and the reasons that underlie the Mishnayos. That's called B'machshak. If you can study Mishnayos, but if you don't understand the deeper meaning that underlies the Mishnah, it's meaningless. You're in the dark. You might fool yourself, as we said before, but you really don't understand unless you get down to the underlying meaning and principles. However, we're up to the second historical period today, meaning at the time of Ravina Ravashi, who were the Sof Chachme HaTalmud, they were the Chasimus HaTalmud. And at that point in time, Bizman Ravina Ravashi, the Eretz Yisrael Hayu Shmados Ugzeros. Now, you know, the thing turned the other way around. And unfortunately, the land of Israel was beset with all sorts of shmad, you know, persecution and gzeros. The Chachmei Yisrael yardu lebavel. So now the scholars go on Yeridah. Instead of being in Eretz Yisrael, they run away from the persecutions in Eretz Yisrael. They end up in Bavel. And there, he says, they developed the Talmud. In that second stage, they developed the Talmud. He says, our Talmud Bavli is Adif mi Talmud Eretz Yisrael. Why? Because the great Chachamim now gravitate to Bavel, running away, as it were, from the Gzeros and the Shmados in Eretz Yisrael, and that's where they developed Talmud Bavli. Says Rav Haigon that this Gemara of Rav Yirmiya, that b'machshakim, the darkness is the Talmud that's studied in Babel. That's not the Talmud Babel that we know today that was developed and signed up by Ravina Ravashi. Adarabba, the Talmud Babel that we know from Ravina Ravashi is greater than the Talmud of Eretz Yisrael. But in the initial period of time, when the Sanhedrin stood in Eretz Yisrael and the Chachmei Yisrael would gravitate to Eretz Yisrael, at that point the situation in Bavel was very dark, it was very bitter. It was a situation of a machshakim hoshivani kimisei olam. But ultimately, says Rav Haigoin, after unfortunately the destruction in Eretz Yisrael, when the Talmidei Chacham and the greats were fugitives, but they gravitated to Bavel, that's where they developed the Talmud Bavli, which is superior to the Talmud of Eretz Yisrael, and it's the Talmud that was described by Rabbi Yochanan as Bavli, Blula b'Mikra, Blula b'Mishnah, u'Blula b'Talmud. So I was very excited about this note of Rav Haigon, because it helps me personally put a lot of this Agadita into perspective. I told you yesterday that my Rebbe used to shy away from Agadita in most cases. Once in a while he would give long lectures on the Agadita when he felt he was comfortable with the Agadita. And I was very afraid to learn this Agadita, because all this Agadita has such a negative spin on Bavel. You have these two ladies in the vision of Zechariah, one of which represents Gassus Ruach, and the other represents Chanufa, and it's all settling down in a permanent location in Eretz Shinar, which is Bavel. I mean, that's very negative about Bavel. We also saw previous Gemaras about how the people in Bavel would fight with each other. They were Mechablim Zedzeh, they were Merorim Zelazeh. And I couldn't put this whole Agadita together in my mind with the concept of Talmud Bavli. I mean, when you ask me where was the greatest synodal of Torah learning in all of Jewish history, I would identify it as Bavel. And all these pejorative, negative statements about Bavel, it just didn't sit well with me. But at least in Rav Haigon, I get a bit of a glimpse of the truth here. The key to unlock the mystery of this Agadita is that we're talking here in this Agadita about an early period in the history of the study of Torah in Bavel. And that's the period of time when the Chachmei HaTorah were located where? In Eretz Yisrael. And that's because the Sanhedrin was up and running, the great scholars were there, and in Bavel there was a very pathetic situation as far as Torah is concerned. But unfortunately, the situation there at Yisrael deteriorated, and the, you know, everything was turned upside down, topsy-turvy, and now Babel becomes the center of Torah learning. Yes.
So the Gemara connects Aeneas with Gassus Ruach. Yeah?
Correct. Aeneas becomes a punishment for Gassus Ruach. And if you see a country, a location where they're suffering from Aeneas, which the Gemara identifies finally as Aeneas B'Torah, then you know that's where there's Gassus Ruach.
Yeah, especially if I understand it correctly. We use the term lealiyutati, my humble opinion.
Correct.
And that's not sarcastic. It's meant.
Correct, because Torah can only be studied with humility. A person who thinks he knows it all, if I'm great, I don't need the Torah. At least I certainly don't need the Torah that you want to teach me, because I'm a gadol by myself. And as a result of Gassus Ruach, the last thing that a person is a receptacle for is Torah, because Torah requires humility.
Yeah.
The Torah is always compared to Mayim, Mayim El Torah, because Mayim go from a high place to the lower place. And Hillel, who was the great scholar, was the personification of Aeneas, of Anova, of humility. And the Gemara says that at one point in his life, he said something which indicated that he was lording it over others, and he forgot his Torah, thousands of halachos, till he got back on the track. And you can speak almost endlessly about the connection between Anova and Torah. The Torah was given on the lowest mountain, which is Har Sinai, in order to indicate Anova. And the Torah is not Gassus Ruach. There's a whole long God at the beginning of Sota, that if you look at a Gassus Ruach, forget about finding Torah there. Torah requires humility. And it's amazing. Rashi says over and over again, Lo Yadati, Lo Ivanti. You know, I didn't hear this from my Rebbeim, and I don't know how to interpret the Torah. And every Gadol, I mean, I saw it by the Rav also. He would be the first to admit that I couldn't figure this out. We don't have the capacity to know all the Torah. And the more you study, the more you realize that you don't know anything. That's what they say in the name of Rav Tenla. It says, Chosh Barosho, Yasuk Batorah. You remember this?
Yeah.
I think I told it to you. You know, if you have a headache, you should study Torah. He says, why? He says, students, you start studying Torah, you realize you have no head. So if you have no head, then eventually you have no headache. And that's what the study of Torah is all about. It's all about humility. And as deep as we try to delve into the Torah, we realize that we barely scratch the surface. And it's just endless. It's pashut rechoka mina yam. It's a bottomless pit. I mean, you know, people. I remember when I was applying to high school. So my father said that in one particular high school that he wanted me to get accepted to, the first Rebbe, the ninth grade Rebbe, that's the first year in America, is an outstanding Rebbe, and he knows half a Shas. So I said to my father, what do you mean he knows half a Shas? Shas is made up of six starim, right? Shisha, Sidrei, Mishnah. So he says he knows Noshim, Nezikin, and Moed. And that's called half a Shas. And I say to myself, who knows the full Shas? Who could really know Taros? I have a friend of mine who told me that he spent years on Masechta Kelim. I'm talking about a big Talmud Chacham. I have two geniuses of my friends. One genius, I'm not going to mention his name, he spent years on Masechta Kelim. Who learns Kelim? Kelim is in Taros and it's very complicated. And he spent years on it. Who can know Kodshim? I mean, the Briskers, for example, will dedicate their entire life, I'm talking about the Israeli Briskers, to study of Kodshim. That's only 1/6 of Shas. Yeah. I have a 3-volume work here. You'll see it right there to your left on the bottom. It's called Nefesh Tova. You see it? This is the Rosh Yeshiva of Chevron Yeshiva. Chevron Yeshiva today has 1,000 students. This is the Rosh Yeshiva of Shlomo Katz. He's got 3 massive volumes on Masechta Zvachim. I mentioned to you before about this great scholar that studied Masechta Kelim. I studied, I had the privilege of learning B'Chavrusa with him, Masechta Peah. How long do you think it took us to learn Peah? A full year. A full year on Masechta Peah. In Zeroyim, Peah is considered like the easiest part of Zeruim. You don't even scratch the surface. It took us a year and we didn't make a sea and we couldn't finish. You know, you get the little taste of the breadth of Torah, of the broadness of Torah. And of course it stimulates you to feel a sense of like humility. I'm standing in front of, you know, this endless massive Chachma of Elokim, and that's only, you know, even that doesn't scratch the surface, because then you talk about Allah and Ashkofa and Kabbalah and Chassidus and the meaning of the Torah, the symbolic meaning. There's Pshat, Remez, Drush, and Sod. There are people who dedicate their entire life to Sod. They try to figure out the secrets of the Torah. I overheard a Chavrusa once in a base medrash, in a small base medrash. I didn't understand a word of what they were talking about. They spoke an entirely different language. And probably if I would ask them, I'm not sure, they would tell you in a very humble way, we don't understand anything of what we're doing. And they could dedicate endless amounts of time. Yeah, I'm sorry.
No, I just wanted to say we have the expression Talmid Chacham.
So right, Talmid. You're always a Talmid. Excellent. Yeah. Ezu Chacham, the Mishnah says, Alomid Mikol Adam. You know, that you have to consider to be a Talmud Chacham, you have to be a Lomid. Lomid means in the Hove, Eloshin in the Hove, you're always a Lomid. Alright, let's begin in Mirz Hashem, the new Mishnah. And whatever we did in the Agadita, we did. And whatever we got, we got. Now, the Mishnah goes back to the issue of Rabbi Meir the Chachamim about accepting, in this case, someone who is possible. Someone who technically, according to the halacha, would be disqualified. Until now, we spoke about the fact that according to Rabbi Meir, Shimon, we called him, the defendant, could disqualify the witnesses under certain conditions that are brought by the plaintiff, by Ruvein the Tovea. He could disqualify the Dayanim. But now we talk about a case in the opposite, where the plaintiff, or, and again we'll see the variations, or the defendant says, I'll accept someone upon me who is not kosher lodun. Amar lo, so one litigant turns to the other and he says that even though a father is certainly disqualified to be a judge in a case for his son, Neman alai Abba, I trust my father. And as far as I'm concerned, he can judge. Or Neman alai Avicha, or I will accept your father. So that's what one litigant says to the other. Here's a third case. Nemanim alai Shlosha Roy Baka. From my perspective, I'm willing to accept the judgment of three individuals who they are not Baki Bedin Torah. They are shepherds that never studied Torah. And now we're going to have a machlokas between Rabbi Meir and Chacham. Both Rabbi Meir and Chachamim agree that this statement, this declaration is binding. You made a declaration that you were willing to accept this person even though he's not roy, he's not suitable for judgment. But the question is, can he backtrack? Can he decide that he's not interested? Rabbi Meir Omiyachal Lachsarbo. Rabbi Meir says that he can change his mind. And he can say, you know what? I want a Dayan who's kosher. I don't want Roy Bucker. I don't know why my father, your father, garnished. The Chacham Omim Eino Yachal Lachsarbo. He cannot change his mind. And this is a pellet, because we have a principle in Halacha called Kinyan Dvarim Einom Eino Kinyan. That normally you need a Kinyan. If you want to be Mischaya, for example, let's say I say, Steve, I'm going to pay you $1,000. Right? The fundraising campaign here was fantastic, and I'm going to give you $1,000 as a gift. I can change my mind. Again, I'm not the most honest guy if I change my mind, but according to the strict letter of the law, up until the point that I make a Kinyan, which means a Kinyan Suda, right? I say to you here, let's make a Kinyan Suda. And at that point, it is absolutely binding and irretractable. But here, there was no Kinyan. So, look, Orr Meir is right. It was a very nice declaration on his part, very magnanimous, that he was willing to accept the other Baldin's father as a judge, but there was never a Kinyan made. And for some reason, the Chachamim say, Eino Yochel Lachsarbo. And to be honest with you, I, at this point, would only understand Chachamim in the following case. There were two judges that were already appointed to the court, and they are Ksherim. And now we get to the level of the third judge, and the third judge is either Abba or Avicha. But then I have a problem because in the case of Shlosha Roi Bakar, in the case of Shlosha Roi Bakar, clearly there's not even one member of the court that is suitable, that is a Baki B'din Torah, as a judge. So once again, I don't understand the Chachamim, why they say, after all, there was never a Kinyan made, it was just a statement, a declaration on his part, he could backtrack from any declaration. Says the Nebuke Yosef, here quoted in the footnote, Madua Mo'ila Kabbalah Zu, why is this acceptance, this declaration, effective and binding below Asiyas Kinyan, without a Kinyan? And here he refers us to a Gemara that we learned back on Davav, and again we have to, this is more of the humility that I spoke about before, we have to review what we did on Davav. The Gemara there has a whole sugi about Pshara. Let's say the two Bali Din agree that the judges don't have to really weigh the evidence and come up with a strict decision based on the letter of the law, but rather they can make a compromise, some sort of mediation. And the Gemara comes to the conclusion that Sricha Kinyan, that even though they accepted upon themselves this Pshara, so Reuven is going to be happy if he can collect 500, and Shimon is going to be happy if he only has to pay 500, but they need a Kinyan. Why? Because Meikar Adin, it could be that Shimon has to pay 1,000, or that Reuven doesn't have rights to collect anything. And therefore, if you want to change the din, and now you want to make it effective even with a pshara, which is not alpi din, then you need a kinyan for that. Says the Nuk Yosef, how much more so here, where they're accepting upon themselves the din of a dayan who's not kosher, how can you possibly say that that is binding without a kinyan? How did the Chachamim make any sense when they say any yochel lachzor bo? So the Nebuke Yosef offers the following interpretation. He says, Kevan Shehem Mekablim Osam L'dayon, once they've accepted him as a dayan, is then Asiyas Adin Hu Dovar Barur V'eino Toli Kol Kach B'dayto Shel Adayon. Again, very subtle words over here. Very difficult to really sink your teeth into the answer of the Nebuke Yosef. And he basically says that, like, the evidence of the case does 90% of the talking of the din. The din is made up mostly of the objective evidence. So he says, in the case of Pshara, which undermines all the evidence because there's no, either he owes him 1,000 or he doesn't owe him a dime. But how do you come up with this pshara? It means that you're undermining the whole process of din, all the birur that's going to be objectively brought in front of the court as evidence. So the entire entity of pshara is a result of daito. Shal Hadayan Sha'osa Pshara. It's all his das. In other words, he's the one who's creating the Pshara and he's undermining din. And therefore, who's going to rely on such a person who is undermining din and coming up with his own das about how to divvy up the money? That requires a tremendous, what's called Smichas Das, a tremendous, complete, absolute decision on the part of the Bali Dinim that they will invest all the authority in the Dayan to create a Pshara. And he'll decide what's going to be with the money based on his own decision. For that commitment and smichas das, you need a kinyan. Masha Enkin, in the case of a dayan, which if I understand the language here of the Nebuke Yosef correctly, he's saying that din, and asiyas din, is a davar barur, v'eino toli kol kach b'dayto shal adayan, that relative to the case of a pshara, where all the powers and all the authority are being given to the das of the dayan, who's going to undermine din and come up with a pshara, here we want din, and basically we're asking this dayan to evaluate the evidence, and if you've made a commitment that even this dayan who's technically puzzle, or you've relying on the Roy Buck who have a certain intuition of what is right based on weighing the objective evidence, in that case you don't need that complete smichus das, and the statement, the declaration that you will accept their judgment is binding in an irretractable way according to the Chacham. That's what I got out of this Nemuke Yosef. I'm more impressed by the question than I am by the answer, because I still don't understand, according to the Chachamim, how you can tell me that you can change the rules of the game and appoint a Dayan who's not a Dayan, he doesn't have the qualifications of a Dayan, and then you're going to tell me any Yochel Lachzor, but there was no Kinyan, it was only a verbal declaration and a statement. I don't understand how that works. Let's just quickly finish up the Mishnah. The Mishnah says, Hayachayev lechaver shvua, in a case where, let's say there was one witness, or whatever the case is, Shomer, and he has to take a shvua, and a shvua chamura means that you have to mention the name of God. That's what gives the power of the shvua, the name of Hashem. The Amarlo, and the other Baldin says, you know what? I'm going to waive my right to demand a shvua from you. And instead, give me a half a shvua, not the real Makoy shvua. Darli, which means take an oath, Bechaye Roshcha, not with the name of God, but a lower level of a shvua, which is called Bechaye Roshcha, I swear on my life, so to speak. And Rav Meir Omer Yochel Lachzor, but once again, since Mikra Dini has the right to collect a shvua and demand a shvua, then he can change his mind. V'chachomim omrim eino yochol lachzor. Okay, Rav Osai, we'll stop here. Take this opportunity to wish everyone a great Shabbos, and we should emirtz Hashem be zochet to that level of Talmidei Chachom Shemeretz Yisrael, no longer Mechiras Yosef, and then we should have Achdus in Klal Yisrael.
What was the quote from Rav Tendler?